Step into the wealth elevator and join our 12,000 plus member community who have passively invested over $200 million to acquire over $2.1 billion in commercial real estate. Sign up by going to thewealthelevator.com/club, and here we go.
This is a story about a dude named Lane. He moved to the mainland and bought one place to stay. And then one day he went and tried to rent them out. And then he became one real investor man.
Hey, Simple Past the Cash Flow listeners. Today we have another coaching call for an accredited investor. Net worth is around a couple million. He's got a pretty decent size rental property portfolio, but the question we're going to try and answer and strategize is, how do we get into the simple passive cash flow gravy train, pay less taxes while working the day job? Hey, Steve, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Thanks for doing this. I know a lot of people will get a lot of value out of it, and I think a lot of people will get to your position one of these days. But why don't you give people a little bit background on yourself and how you came into this world of alternative investing? And
okay. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity, Lane. Again, my name is Steve. I'm an accredited investor. I actually own a company in the construction industry here in California where I reside. I've been living in California now for about 20 years. Originally grew up in Pennsylvania and made my way west, stopped in Texas for a few years where I worked as a mechanical engineer before I transitioned into sales and made my way to California. Even had a background. I worked at UBS in financial services for 2 years in between doing equipment sales and ended up acquiring a business from one of the competitors to where I had sold equipment before, which was a nice transition since I had quite a bit of background in mechanical engineering. But the time at UBS did open my eyes up a lot about what's going on. It was very interesting to see that most financial advisors there knew absolutely nothing about investing. And I don't know if I should really say that or not, but most of the financial advisors were really there to gather assets. And there was a financial planning aspect. I shouldn't say that. I learned a ton in the couple of years I was there. And it was a good way for me to diversify from my mechanical engineering background and really learn a lot about some other things before I ended up acquiring the business and really starting to grow that and really start to, build my net worth. My first rental property, I purchased a fourplex back in Pennsylvania next to where I went to university, probably about 15 years ago. I knew some other people. I knew the area because it was by where I went to school back at Bucknell. So I bought a place back there. And that's more of a place where you're going to see a cash flowing type real estate. You're not going to see a lot of appreciation. I don't know that it was the best investment when I made it. It was a fairly old building, and definitely over the years I've put some money into that because it was probably a 100-year-old building when I bought it. For the most part, I do get, at this point, 15 years later, I get quite a bit of cash flow off of it. For the most part, that one's almost paid off. But then I hooked up with another property manager there, and they started bringing me deals back there. And then I bought another unit that actually bought the unit next door to the one that I had, which was a vacant building at the time. The owner really just didn't keep up with it, and it lost its occupancy permit at some point. I had the opportunity a few years ago to kind of go and add to my portfolio there. And so I went and bought that building and fixed that up. And that was a 7-unit apartment building next to the fourplex I bought. And the sevenplex I found actually after it took a while and a significant amount of money and probably more money than I'd originally budgeted, which is especially, that's again, another probably 100-year-old building that wasn't occupied at the time, but it was right next to the building I owned, and actually cleaning that one up and getting that fully rented now probably made the building I have next to it probably a little bit more valuable. At least that's one of the symmetries I thought about.
Well, let's pause there, Steve, a little bit. Let's catch people up. Okay. So your profile is pretty typical. A lot of my investors are engineers, technical background. You've moved off to a different industry, but today's you're in sales. And that's something I notice is very common. The guys who are the linear path thinkers are the ones that stay in their technical roles. And you guys, I'm sure you'll vouch for this, that I've heard it from a lot of other people in similar situation, that the sales job, that if you can speak the technical language in the sales job, that's like the ideal strategy and lifestyle and highest pay.
Oh, for sure. And now I own a company where I hire technical salespeople. And I actually have a very interesting story about how I was recommended to go into technical sales. I don't know if it's interesting or not, but if you can actually speak the technical language and understand the interpersonal relations with people and going out and convincing them and being able to speak in layman's term and be able to speak the technical jargon and be able to accurately and quickly learn products and be able to actually articulate and go out and speak to people, yeah, you can earn a lot more money than the person that's just going to sit there and, you know, run calculations and not be able to have those effective communication skills. I think, especially now that I hire a lot of people doing that as well, to find that person that can handle both the technical aspect and the people aspect, it's a rare commodity. And it sounds like you're in that boat as well with a technical background.
Yeah, we can do a spreadsheet or two, but we can talk to people.
Yeah, most anybody can learn to talk to people, they can learn to do the spreadsheet, but it's some of those innate qualities of being able to have the intercommunication skills and being able to relate to other people, sometimes more difficult to learn that side of the business.
And I think as an accredited investor, that's the name of the game, is building connections with other accredited investors. Of course, getting in the right room is a big thing, but once you're in the right room, being able to build organic relationships, which I think kids these days, especially in a pandemic world, are just SOL.
It'll be interesting to see what happens. I have a daughter. That's one of the other things about my background. I have an 11-year-old daughter now, and last year she finished up her school on Zoom. This year, you know, she's doing 2 days a week in Zoom and 2 half days in person. Really being able to learn at that age to form those interpersonal relationships is probably one of the most important things in life. And if you're having to do school on Zoom and not really having some of the, it's going to be interesting to see how that affects the long-term impacts of our society. Hopefully it's only for a year here, but we can get back to normal and the kids aren't, they can get back to forming those interpersonal relationships. And really probably, you know, one of the best things about learning, at least that's some of the things I hope for the next generation, especially with my daughter.
You're right on the verge here. Your net worth is around $2.5 million. If we can get you up to 4.5, we can turn that daughter into a trust fund kid pretty easily. So we don't have to worry about that too much.
Yeah. And to be honest, like that's my net worth excluding my business.
Yeah. That's icing on top of the cake. Let's try and
that's
get there.
That's just top of the cake. And that's how I've looked at it from my personal perspective. If at the end of the day, I do want to sell that business, and if I am fortunate enough to be able to get anything out of selling that business, that'll just be icing on the cake. I really want to build my net worth and my passive income so that I don't have to rely on my primary business during the day. And I don't have to worry about it, because I have seen, and that's one of the things I've seen in my life, so many small business owners really just overvalue their business. And when they go to sell it, they put such a high value on their business, they can't sell it because they can never get as much as they think it's worth. And I guess I've been coached along the way, because I've been on both sides of the fence working. I did sales and then I did a little bit of financial advisory work. And now I'm a business owner, so I try to see it from all sides of the perspective here. I don't want to have to rely on being able to sell my business for an astronomical amount that I might not be able to get someday to be able to retire. I really want to build my assets and my passive income to, you know, really be able to take care of my lifestyle outside of my business. And then if I am fortunate enough to be able to sell my business for a good amount at some point, you know, that'll be, like you said, icing on top of the cake.
Yeah. I think what I would like for you is get proof of concept with this $2 million before, see if this is all a sham or not.
Yeah, for sure.
So that when you can sell the business, you definitely just turbocharge yourself and go into light speed with this stuff. We work with hardworking professionals looking to opt out of investments for the clueless. I mean, mainstream investing. We work with people we have a direct relationship while enjoying higher returns and a quicker path to financial freedom. I personally moved my endorsement from turnkey rentals to syndications as my net worth has grown. However, the downside of many of these deals is that you need at least $50,000 to invest, and the frequency of deals that meet my criteria is sporadic. Check out my article at simplepassivecashflow.com/ofund and learn how I always have cash on hand by using the American Home Preservation Fund as part of this 1-2 punch to be ready for a great deal while still making a double-digit return. I have been investing in AHP since 2016. AHP is a crowdfunding solution to the mortgage crisis in America, where collectively, the fund and investors, like you, pull their money together and get great bulk discounts on distressed mortgages. It's a business model that I think gets stronger should a bump in the economy come, because this is where there will be even more distressed inventory for AHP to purchase. The American Home Preservation Fund aims to keep people in their homes
so you can make a 10% return while making a positive social impact. Invest in as little as $100 by going to ahpservicing.com/investors. And if you want the free Burn Zone book and learn about George Newberry's story, please send me an email at lane@simplepassivecashflow.com.
I like to buy stuff. Well, that's a liability.
Going back to the rentals, so like this one, 606 Lake, and this one here, you bought in a previous life, right? A long time ago. Where were you at, like career-wise or like net worth-wise back then? Or
so career-wise, I didn't have much of a net worth probably then. And the 606 Lake Street, to be honest, I've never sold a piece of real estate. Gave one away in a divorce one time, but I've never sold a piece of real estate. 606 Lake Street was one of my first purchases, but it's a condo in the city that I live in. And it was my primary residence at the time. I was very fortunate in life when I did go into technical sales. I was able to quickly become probably one of the top technical sales reps in the company that I was working for very quickly and became a high earner. You know, I was making a high six-figure income at that time. Really, I started out of college with maybe $1,000 in my pocket just from working summers lifeguarding back in Pennsylvania. So I really didn't have much of a net worth, but I was fortunate when I did go into sales, I lived off of my base salary and every one of my bonuses that I got from doing sales, I started putting away. Started maxing out my 401k every year as I moved to California 20 years ago. So that's really helped as well. But you know, like I said, that 606, I really didn't have much of a net worth then. I was fortunate enough to have a 10% deposit, which surprisingly in 2005, when I went to the bank and told them I had enough for a 10% deposit, they're like, wow, most people hardly have anything. Because that was the time when everybody was doing neg-am loans and all kind of crazy things that ended up causing that great recession in 2007. But so I'd say I really didn't have a lot of a net worth at that point. I was really just starting to build from scratch, if you will. I was fortunate enough to be successful at work. I was working as a sales engineer during the day. Had a pretty good high six-figure income at the time for being fairly young at the time in my 20s. But I went and bought the 606 Lake Street. Again, that was my primary residence at the time. After I moved out, I really just turned it into a rental. The 119 place in Pennsylvania, I went and acquired that as sort of somewhat trying to start building my passive income and as an investment strategy as well. But
So if you guys have been, also check this out on the YouTube channel. We have the personal financial sheet up and the property cash flow worksheet up. Steve was talking. I was playing around with some numbers here. I got the amount of equity you have in each of these properties, and I did some quick calculations on the percentage of equity you have. So the game plan here is to go after, you kind of know this. You know how this game, we got to go shoot the, I don't know, whatever animal you like to eat, buffalo, the fattest buffalo here. So that's probably looking at like this 301 North property that you acquired in 2016. You have no mortgage on it, is that right?
No, I bought that one for cash. And being that one's in the South, that I was fortunate enough to, I think, catch a good rise. And versus the properties I bought in the Northeast, I would say never really appreciated that much. That one, which was in the South, you seem to get good appreciation down there because so many of the folks are moving from the Northeast and going South, it seems.
Exactly. Yeah, it's Great Shifts is the book about that. What did you buy that one for?
I bought that for $65,000 cash. I just paid cash for it at the time, but it was located in a redeveloping area outside of a city down in Florida. It was a redeveloping area at the time. And it's funny, on that property, I probably get 2-3 calls a week from people trying to buy that property from me now. But I bought it for about $65,000. I did have to go in and I needed a new air conditioner, some new plumbing, some new electrical, but it's a nice 3-bedroom property down there in Florida.
And you didn't put any other like improvements in it? A $225,000 capital gain, is that right?
I don't know. I guess that's an estimate. It could be a high estimate too.
I mean, people always say, oh, I got to check with my CPA. It's like, your CPA, it's going to take them 2 hours to figure this out. And they're going to ask you the same questions I'm asking you now.
That could be a little bit of a high estimate. Yeah, that could be a little bit of a high estimate on that property. But that's what I do get quite a bit of calls. Nobody's probably quite offered me that for it, but like I said, I did make some improvements on it. Like I did new plumbing, new electrical, new air conditioning. There were a couple, maybe new windows and things like that. And it was about 5 years ago. But that part of Florida really seems to have been a redeveloping area. And I think I got that one for a pretty good deal. I bought it from somebody who was looking to sell it. It was a cash as is deal. So I'm sure I bought that way under market at the time as well. So it was probably also a good purchase. This is $300,000. It might be. Maybe it's only $250,000, or maybe it's even $200,000, but It's definitely probably, it's in that range. I don't know. I've always put 300 in there. But.
Okay. Let me just fetch it down to 250.
Yeah.
Just for calculation's sake. And then what I'm also trying to do is you got to add a little bit more, maybe like 20 grand to each of these for the depreciation recapture.
Okay.
You know what that is, right? Like you're probably making a loss on the building value every year. And then this, the property that you bought 15 years ago, 2005, 2006, maybe I'm just going to hard type that in an extra, maybe 50 grand.
So how do you monetize that depreciation recapture, if you will? Because I don't know, is there a way to monetize that or?
I'm just throwing in a placeholder of 50 grand. Here's how you do it. What'd you buy this one at? The 606 Lake, what'd you buy it at?
So I actually paid $665,000 for that one back in 2005.
Okay, and where's this at? Okay, so expensive area. So this is good for taxes because I'm just shooting from the hip here. Like usually 1/3 of the property value or 0.33% of that $665,000 is the building value.
Yeah, so the improvements versus the land, correct.
And some of the other ones I'll use 1/3 for or 2/3 of the building. So that's the total building value is 221,000. And then I'm going to divide that by 27 years.
Yeah. And I know my accountant on an annual basis on my taxes does use some of that. And I don't know what the numbers are off the top of my head, but I know my accounting firm that I use do depreciate those assets and the rentals versus the net income that I get from it on an annualized basis.
Yeah. So they are probably doing around $8,200 a year. And we're doing the math right here. It's super simple. It's not perfect, but it's close enough for government work or for our purposes. Yeah. You've owned this for what, 15 years?
Yeah, about 15 years.
So I'm going to say $123,000 is what I think you should add to your capital gain.
Oh, I see. So what you're saying is, you're adding that back into the capital gain.
Yeah. So I'm going to do that the same thing to that other one that you bought in 2008. That one you bought, for what, 200?
No, 100, yeah, 189,000.
Okay. Just call it 200 grand just to be more conservative. And that's in California too, or?
No, that one's in Pennsylvania. So that the land value is probably much less for sure there compared to
We'll call it half because half are Democrats, half are Republicans. Stay away from that. I don't know. I don't know how it's definitely not like Texas or Alabama or Georgia. I don't know. Let's just call it half. This is a split state, as we know.
It is. It's a split state for sure.
And then you owned that one for what, about 14 years?
Yep.
So boom, yes. 51 grand. So then we add that to that. And then this is our real tax one. This one, we could probably do the same math. Actually, I don't know if I want to do that, but I just added.
That has such a low purchase price. Yeah.
Yeah. These are like you bought it so little bit. Only like a few years ago, it's probably not much. Yeah. If I would just be conservative, maybe add an extra 20 grand. I don't know. But the big ones we got right.
Yeah.
So the reason why I'm doing that is like, you're going to sell these things, but let's also look at, it's a two-factor decision here. We have to go kill the buffalo that is the fattest and not doing anything, the laziest money, which is this one and this one. But we also have to factor in, all right, when we do that, will we have $195,000 of passive losses to offset that transaction. This is the decision process. Or if instead, maybe we go after this one first. That's $150,000 of passive losses. Or I know you went into the last deal with us in Houston. I don't know how much you put in, but let's just say you put in 100.
I didn't do the Houston one. I did the Dallas one and the Alabama one. So I did two deals. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the Dallas one. Hopefully you got your check already.
I did. Yes, I got my first check from investing in one of the simple passive cash flow in one of Lane's deals. So holy, I did. I just got it. Yeah, it worked. I got my first check. So check.
Oh, you did. You get your K-1.
No, I didn't get a K-1. I did. I invested in that one. It was called The Colony. I invested in that one this summer. What was it? Maybe June or May, June?
Yeah, so you haven't got your K-1. You'll get your K-1 in March for that.
Yeah.
My guess, that was pre- all these, so like lately, like all these deals have like these COVID reserves, which dilutes the pot. So it lowers the amount of deduction. So I think with Colony, don't quote me on this, of course, where I'm recording here, but maybe you're going to see if you put in 100 grand, you're going to get like $60,000 to $80,000 of passive losses back.
Okay.
Let's just go with that. Okay. So I don't know how much passive losses you have. You have to look up, I think it's the 58 something form. People can figure out this form. Go to my tax page at simplepassivecashflow.com/tax. But this is a question to ask your CPAs. Okay. Can you go to my tax 58 or whatever form and tell me how much passive losses I have now? I'm just guesstimating with the amount of stuff you have. I'm guessing you have maybe $100,000 of passive losses, plus or minus 50 is what I'm guessing. So
it's with your possible, I don't know off the top of my head, but yeah.
Usually you're surprised that you have more than what you think. Typically,
okay.
Labeled as PALs. So now you have to, you went into the colony for 100 grand. Let's just say you get, I don't know, to be conservative, $60,000 of passive losses. So now you're walking around with $160,000 of passive losses.
And then I did the one in Alabama too, which is, that was more of a buildup deal. I don't know if there's going to be passive losses for that.
Yeah, not until we put the asset in service. So that'll be on the 2021 K-1. Just to show this scenario, let's say that was a regular deal, right? Where it wasn't the development deal where you got the losses this year, or it was already making money. As long as we're making $1, we can give you the losses that exceed the income. So let's just say that one, maybe you got $70,000 of passive losses. I'm just saying. Yeah. So you add this up. Let's just say you're walking around with $230,000 of passive losses. So that would allow you to sell this asset, take your $195,000 depreciation recapture and tax hit, but then you have $230,000 to offset it. So you deduct this from your $230,000 and you should still have some leftover. But you take this deal and there's what, $250,000 of equity. And that's the game plan. You get the deployment tab. We'll get to the deployment tab on this personal financial sheet, but that might be, I don't know what your goals are for 2021, but maybe that's your goal, is to invest all $250,000 into two or three deals, whatever.
Okay.
And then let's just say you invest that money and at a 50% ratio, maybe you get $125,000 of more passive losses to replenish that. That kind of makes sense.
Yeah. So if I invested that 250, I might get another 125,000 passive losses for the following year.
Yeah. And this is what I call the simple passive cash flow gravy train. You don't seem like a drug user, but if you were a drug user in the rock and roll days, this is going from one high to the next. Any questions on that?
No, I kind of get the concept where you're redeploying, you're selling those assets that are appreciated and going back in and redeploying those assets in something that's flowing more cash. That's, or a higher rate of return, really, that's what you're talking about doing.
You got a lot of things going on. You got the which buffalo you're going to go and hunt down first. This isn't going to happen overnight. This is probably taking 2 or 3 years to sell all these.
Yeah. And then I've been redeploying quite a bit of cash. I made probably $400,000 or $500,000 in investments this year alone, just based off of last year was a good year. My income as a business owner now is completely variable, but in a good year, I can go and invest a significant sum as well.
And I think that's good. Like, you segregate, that's what I do with my business and education side. Like, I segregate my investing and sometimes I'll have, even my wife will have her investment stuff that I segregate even more just so I can see how I'm doing. But we'll look at this personal financial sheet. And what I looked here is like, all right, what velocity are you moving at just at a cash flow standpoint? So you make about 37,000 of income, your expenses going out is actually pretty good. I've seen people that make a third of the less money of you have just as much expenses. So you're doing a good job there. The magic number, the net, is 27,000 a month. So yeah, you're in the top 1% of my investors. I would say if you're able to net more than 100 grand, you're doing super well.
Okay. Yeah. And to be honest, like, those income numbers they don't really include the profits of my business either. In good years, it can be significantly higher than that. But in bad years, if you run a business in any type of industry, especially with COVID this year, we may not make it. We're certainly not going to make a lot of bonuses or anything like that other than that.
But. Yeah, yeah. And a lot of my clients are just working stiffs, the W-2 guys. But there are some business owners, definitely a minority of my clients are business owners, so they can relate. But yeah, I would say whether you're a business owner or you're a W-2 guy, if you're netting more than 100 grand a year and your net worth is $1 million at least, you're on the you're going to be in 5 or 10 years, you're going to hit financial freedom unless you spend a lot of money.
Yeah. But that is the trick, because if it's sitting there, people tend to spend it.
Yeah. Yeah. But the reason why I just want to point that out to you is because you're doing like better than 2.5 times that. So you're going to get there. I don't know what kind of lifestyle you live, but yeah, fly first class, buy a nice car. Yeah. Relax a little bit. Take your time getting there.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So yeah, I think that's just a matter of, you don't really need to sell these types of properties because you have so much cash flow coming in. You can invest your normal liquidity, mm-hmm. but maybe just, I don't know if these are fun to you. They're probably not. What rental property is fun? Just to simplify your life and lower your liability, getting rid of these rental properties. Like, I would be concerned with one of these rental properties than 10, the liability and 10 or 20 LP investments.
Okay.
I don't know what you're doing with asset protection now. We don't have to get into this, but because it's recorded, but for you, I would definitely be looking into more of an irrevocable trust or something more heavy duty, like a bridge trust.
Yeah, we can talk about that. I really haven't done too much. Yeah, there are certainly things I have done already, but yeah. I don't know if I've done everything yet either on that.
But yeah, definitely get rid of the direct rentals, simplify your life. But yeah, any questions you had?
Some of the things I really haven't, you said you are a proponent of the infinite banking thing, and that was something I put on there. Yeah. You know, I've had a couple scenarios run, and I guess, how do you utilize that infinite banking concept? Do you yourself have a whole life policy and do that? It is something I'm looking into, but haven't really done it, but it is something you've mentioned to me before. I've heard on your things that you do. How do you utilize that? And does that help increase your cash flow?
I personally do it, but you got to find other guys that are in your situation. I guess maybe you and I are in the same situation. A lot of guys in my mastermind, I put them together because they're in the same situations. They're W-2 guys. Yeah. But I need to have a few $100,000 in case a deal doesn't go that well, or we need to put money in escrow as a requirement of the lender. So for me, it's a very good like place to store liquidity because I need it on hand. Whereas if you're just a W-2 guy, doctor, you don't really need that much liquidity. You can run pretty lean. I don't know how you do things, whether you keep cash reserves in the business.
I do keep cash reserves within our business as well. And we have obviously lines of credit with our corporate banking relationships. We have lines of credit for things with the business as well. But I do like to keep some liquidity on hand, but I have gone and invested very aggressively at times and taken that down. You know, I do need to keep some liquidity, obviously, because of the rental properties, because things come up. You might need a new roof somewhere. You might need a bunch of appliances somewhere, but
worry about if it's 50 grand, 100 grand or less, that's menial, right? Like I'm talking a capital overlay of $250,000, $500,000 for your business that you could potentially need. That's what use infinite banking for personally. Okay. But yeah, I would probably put you in the category of just, you can probably run pretty lean with your liquidity. Therefore, you can load up your infinite banking and just start investing the majority of it. What I'm saying is, for me, I load up my infinite banking, but I got to keep it in there.
My thought with the infinite banking was I could load up money in there and then deploy it into something like these LPs or other rental investments or other potential passive cash flow.
For you, it's a no-brainer. But for the guy who's like under $500,000 net worth, they need to get every penny they have and not funnel it through something where they're going to get hit on fees 10, 20% their first few years. They need to invest it. Where this is perfect for you because you're a little bit inefficient with your liquidity. You got a bunch of liquidity parked in rentals. You got money coming in.
I don't know if I call some of those rentals liquidity.
But just in your like your month, your net 200,000 plus a year. I don't know what your practice is on your just personal finances, on your checking account, savings account, how much liquidity do you keep in there? But I would move towards keeping most of it in your infinite banking and maybe less than 10, 20 grand in your checking account.
Okay. But so that's like, what you do. Some of your cash on hand, you move into the infinite banking, because even if you're getting that 3-4%, at least that's what I've seen from some of the illustrations that, you know, and it also takes that, 4 to 5 years now, maybe 6 years to where what you're putting in kind of hurdles over the, to you're actually getting money. You need to be setting it up where that whole life policy needs to run for a significant amount of time before you start seeing higher cash values than what you're putting into it.
Yeah, but if you would have taken all those like fancy things they show you, it's not entirely true. They don't compare it if you would have taken that money and put it into a rental or syndication. If you do that, that's going to skyrocket way more. So there's an opportunity loss cost that not taking into effect. But you don't need to be super efficient, right? Like you're paying costs to silo to put this money that's tax-free and it is off the table of litigators for the most part. There's a benefit you're getting and there's a cost you're paying for it. And for you, it's a no-brainer. But so it's just to what extent? Let me just throw something out. Let me know what your thoughts are. If you're able to save 200 grand a year and you're making a commitment to at least going into a couple deals every year, so maybe $150,000 you're deploying every year religiously, and that leaves you 50 grand of play money, maybe I would throw in at least 30 grand a year. I would feed into a policy.
Okay. Yeah, I had been looking at 25, but yeah, that's kind of the range.
I always say, I tell people start off with a lot less than they think they need, because when I did it, I did 50 grand a year. I got a few years in, I was like, oh shoot, this is a lot of money, because then I started to go into all these deals and my money disappeared.
Yeah, your liquidity dries up outside of your cash flow bank, at least it would disappear, yeah.
But now my deals are starting to go full cycle and cash out, so I have big liquidity events. So now I'm going to make a much bigger policy for myself to right size. And that's the idea. Like once you make a policy, like my strategy is making a policy. They're usually like 5 to 7 years. Get as the shortest period as you can. And then go in knowing that maybe in the next 2 or 3 years, as you start to see this strategy play out, you layer another one on top of it. You layer another one on top. Like
layering whole life policies or infinite banking concept type policies, if you will. You don't necessarily need to do it all at once. You can go in and do one and just get the shortest time frame to where it's actually cash flowing.
Like flexible. Yeah. I don't think it's too much of a pain to do the physical thing and do the application.
No, it's not that. Yeah.
I say that because the life insurance guy is always going to be like trying to sign you up for the longest one. Like it's salesman nature. You know, you're the salesman.
Yeah, you want the one with the shortest duration. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then for me, especially as a business owner, tax reduction strategies really have to be top of mind. And especially living in California, the California government seems to be going crazy on us with what they want to do for taxes. Not to mention, we're going to be coming under a new administration who's already talking about maybe increasing taxes as well. Tax reduction strategies obviously are something that are very key to me as well. And I don't know if you guys have any good tax reduction strategies or what you do for tax reduction strategies.
Yeah, you're damn right we do. This is why like people are interested in deals, but when they come into the mastermind, they start to realize that deals is only 1/3 of the picture.
Yeah.
And the bigger part is keeping most of your money by paying very little taxes.
Yeah, that's, I feel like I was fairly tax efficient, but my tax bills are enormous, and not even just to the federal government, also to the state of California, where there's significant sums on an annualized basis. There's ways to better recapture some of that. I'm definitely open to listening to that.
Where is your current AGI at now, approximately, adjusted gross income?
Last year, it was probably, after certain adjustments, like you said, it is variable. I don't know. It was probably in the $600,000-$700,000 range last year.
Yeah. So you're probably in the category of most doctors. So the general idea is we're trying to get you out of the red zone, which is under $330,000 or so married filed jointly.
Yeah.
Are you married?
No, filing single now, divorced.
Oh, no. We got to find you somebody who's willing to just play. Never mind.
There's plenty that would probably do that. But
I got a lot of single pilot investors for some reason, like 4 or 5 of these guys. And I keep telling them the same thing. So this whole real estate professional status, 750 hours, you can't do it, my friend. I'm sorry. This is another idea. Maybe for the next 5 to 10 years is you sell your business and you become more of a passive entity, right?
Okay.
This is another hierarchy thing you need to be thinking about is changing your income from ordinary to passive. And most people think of it as terms of changing their W-2 job to more rental property syndications, but it can also mean changing your business, whether it's a chiropractic business or your business, where you're not an operation. You don't do work. You just have other people work for you. And the business category to the I category, but Maybe you can munch on that in your head over the holidays or something like that. But for now,
I'm certainly, I always try to adjust it. And my income, it is not all of it comes out as W-2 income. Certainly, a large portion comes from distributions from profitability on the company versus W-2 income.
But in a perfect world, if you could maybe sell the business to some other poor soul who wants to do all the work, create a royalty stream for yourself in a way. But
I know the guy that we ran a corporate office building, and I know the guy comes around on the first of the month, or he did before he passed away, that he owned like 10 of those buildings. Kind of an interesting guy, and just, yeah, you work way too hard for all your money. Because on the first of the month, I just drive around and pick up checks. So.
Exactly. Yeah. That's where you get to. Yes. Like for me, I don't make that much active income.
It all comes as passive income. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But.
And that's what I'm trying to get to the point where I am generating more passive income. And I've taken some steps.
I still think your highest and best use is just keep doing your business because you do well there.
Yeah, so you're for gonna sure. Have... Yeah, I'm not looking to give that up anytime soon. But I also want to have that safety net of substantial passive income that I can switch back into a lower gear if I need to at some point, or if something happens, or if I can't sell the business.
I want you to keep working your day job because that's your highest and best use. That's like Tom Brady when, I don't know how old he is, but he's just keep throwing the football.
Tom's almost my age. I don't know how he's still throwing. He's younger than me by I think a year or two. I don't know how he can still throw a football like that. I went out on the beach and was throwing a football the other day in a flag football game, and you know, this is actually like even a year or two ago. And I was like, I don't know. My arm was about to fall off after.
Yeah. And the same analogy.
He's in better shape for me. But
I bet he's super sore still, too. I think his arm is falling off. But and same thing for you. I know the business gives you headaches. But I think just do it a few more years, maybe 5 or 10. I don't know. Get it to a level where it's manageable. But like now you're trying to create legacy wealth from your family. You're going to blow past $4.5 million. I'm looking we want to get you to 8 figures.
Yeah, I think it's definitely within the realm of possibility with my trajectory. And obviously, you got to get a few lucky bounces along the way, and you got to hope nothing catastrophic happens. And you got to plan for the worst. You got to plan for the best. Also, make contingencies in case something bad happens. But yeah, if everything keeps going the way it is, and I keep being fortunate like I have been in my life and keep working hard, I think I should be able to blow past that. I'm just on the precipice of starting to build wealth. And like I said, I acquired that company about 10 years ago. And when I did that, obviously, all of my rental property purchasing stopped, all those types of things, and everything got dumped into the company. And now I'm just actually getting to the point where I'm starting to get out of the company some of everything I had to put back into it when I first started it years ago.
So again, real estate professional status. We'll talk again if you ever get married, try and integrate that. And for people listening, what we're talking about is using the passive losses to lower his AGI down to that 300 level, or when Biden starts to just destroy people over that $400,000 AGI mark. But that's the game there. But since
as soon as I become a real estate professional, if you will, then I can net off these passive losses from investing in your LPs or from my other real estate properties against my income.
And you do 750 hours of active participation.
Okay. So but you have to do whatever it does to get qualified as a real estate professional.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. But because you are a single guy and you operate a full-time business, it ain't going to happen for you.
Yeah,
but
I know. I mean, my account, I actually had my real estate license at one point when I went and just got it years ago when I started doing some real, I let it lapse. Now I don't have it anymore.
Yeah, but really that's a misnomer. So that's not going to help you get the 750 hours of active participation. Yeah, it's not in your personal portfolio is going to be those rental properties, or what a lot of guys will do is they just get a little dinky short-term rental and play that off, or they do a little dinky flip, just pure for taxes. But they can't have that full-time day job, which is why you need a spouse that is willing to not have a day job. That's difficult. Yeah.
There's plenty of those out there looking for that position.
Oh, we should have a dating thing. That's why in the mastermind thing, I put it here.
Yeah, okay.
We're not going to matchmake people. We're just going to get together and talk about dating tips and stuff like that.
Okay.
So for you, like the only thing that you have is, and I don't do these myself personally, but I know a lot of guys in my group does them, is like the land conservation easements, donating money at a 5-to-1 multiplier at most. Staying out of like the prohibited transaction or the greedy land where you're abusing the system to bring down your taxable AGI. or different other strategies like oil and gas investments, which isn't the best thing these days. And it's really hard to find an operator in that. But really, those are the only options to you. The analogy I use a lot is the passive loss is real estate professional status. That's good diet and exercise, good sleep, right? It's the holistic solutions to good health. Okay. You can't do that, Steve. We can only give you like Lipitor or whatever, like high blood pressure. Like it's gonna bring you back from the edge right now. That's all you got. And ideally, you don't want to be doing that stuff forever. We got to get you to a point. But yeah, whatever life choices you want. You'll be fine, but
I want to start working on building more of my life resume and not so much at the office, I guess, at some point. But yeah, I got to keep doing the office thing for a while longer, for sure, to get to that point. But
right. But those are your options. And if you're at $600,000 AGI and the goal is to get you around 300 or less, maybe throw in 50 grand into a land conservation easement to get $250,000 of lower your AGI. But there's a max you can do that, I think. And this is where all the things always change. And this is why we mastermind about this stuff. And we have that group. We're just going over this on a high level, folks. Yeah. Not giving you advice.
Yeah, I've not heard of that land conservation easement. I'll have to do a little bit of research into that.
There's a page on my website that kind of has an overview. I think it's at simplepassivecashflow.com/land. I think currently you can only do 50% of your income now. So I don't know if it's AGI or MAGI or what, but you can't drive your entire AGI down to zero.
You won't be able to qualify for a loan again either.
Nor would you want to, but there's been a lot of scrutiny over these things, which I think is a little overblown, but people are doing these fee simple arrangements where I don't entirely know what the heck it is, but I know you for fee simple, you can only drive it down 30%. But I still think that's good enough, right? Like I'm not saying... Yeah. Go from 600 down to 300, but maybe this year, if you want to try it, maybe put in 20 grand to get $100,000 deduction. See how it works.
Yeah. Right? Okay. Yeah. I'll definitely do a little bit of research on that. Thank you for the tip. I hadn't heard of that before. Yeah,
it's in December already. So you got a couple of weeks of research, buddy. You're going to get on this.
I'll have to get on that for sure. Yeah.
But yeah, guys will do this every year, especially doctors, high paid W-2 guys. They'll do this in combination too with real estate professional status, so you don't burn up their passive losses.
Okay. How does a doctor go about getting a real estate professional designation?
A lot of times they have a spouse that is a homemaker.
Oh, okay. I see.
Yeah.
And they'll go do it.
Yeah. It's pretty common, right?
Yeah. No, it is. Yeah.
It's actually, I do get a lot of clients where it's like both spouses, I have the onboarding call with them and they both come. I'm like, okay, this is refreshing. And they're both super excited about this financial independence stuff. And I'm like, oh my goodness. Don't tell me you guys both love your job. We both love our job. I'm like, oh my goodness. How is that possible? So I always ask like, which of you guys dislike your job the most? Or I don't know.
Yeah.
We got a word in our special way. But typically there's one person that's like, yeah, I'll quit my job part-time.
Okay.
But that's the ideal arrangement. That's what I do. I just use... What I strategize with my accountant is that we just burn up our passive losses to drive it down to nothing, drive the taxes down to nothing, because their logic is a tax savings. I could probably make more money than the potential to pay 10-20% less taxes in a future year.
If you can eliminate taxes, that's the best thing, but the second best thing is delaying them. And if you can delay them by offsetting them by some of the losses and reinvesting it into a future year. Yeah, plus you're making money on all of those investments in the meanwhile.
Here's the argument. For example, let's just say in the scenario where you have $230,000 of passive losses.
Yeah.
And let's just say you already driven your AGI down to $150,000. And for folks listening, if your AGI is less than $250,000, chillax, dude. Like you're not paying that much taxes. For you to drive it down even more and to execute and activate these passive losses that get you even lower, it may not be worth it, because the lower your AGI goes, the less taxes percentage-wise you pay, because we're in a progressive tax system. So what I was telling my accountant was like, why wouldn't we save this extra $100,000 and I'll pay some taxes? But that they ultimately got me to side with their strategy. But I think in different situations, it's different for some people. So not one situation fits everybody. At least you and I can intelligently have this conversation and take that information to intelligently converse with our tax accountant. Because typically, yes, tax accountant is not going to really be mindful of this stuff.
You have to guide them. You need to guide them and know somewhat of the overall strategy for sure.
But anything else?
Any other strategies that you're looking at? I mean, it sounds like I should probably be looking at the infinite banking system. I haven't. I get what you're saying about maybe taking the equity out of some of the properties I have and start to redeploying that at higher yielding assets and possibly limiting liability by going into some of these. And I was happy to see I got my first check this month from the first deal we did. So that's working so far.
You got a lot on your plate, man. You got to sell assets. You got to go into deals. You got to infinite banking and you got to...
I got to run a company on my spare time.
Yeah, maybe do land conservation ease. Dude, join the mastermind. Like, I guarantee you, if I don't double your money, what you paid, I'll let you walk. I'll refund it. Like, it is just no brainer, man. Like, you need to talk. You need to build your network with the right people around you.
Yeah, I definitely have some high net worth friends as well, but some of them are much higher net worth than me, then they aren't necessarily doing some of these strategies because they're already over that.
So that's the problem. They're second generational wealth people.
I have friends, that are like second generational wealth and they didn't start with zero in their bank account when they got out of college and started. So when I can't say I had zero, I was fortunate. At least I didn't have huge loans that were overbearing, but I didn't have obviously that thing that I didn't have anybody to lend me a ton of money or to give me a ton of money to start with. I was started by saving and just driving the first car I had till 200,000 miles.
This is your tribe, man. This is all first generation guys in their like 35 to 55 range. They got kids your age. They're in that $1 to $4 million range. This is your tribe.
Okay. Yeah, I'll definitely look at it then. And how often do you guys meet with the mastermind? And
We do a live Zoom call every couple of weeks. So whatever you got going on, we can take care of. But what I say is I don't want you guys to spend more than a few hours a month with this group. Just jump on the calls. We record them. So that's going to keep you busy. But use the database to just book a call with every member and see who you get along with. We got a lot of people in California and you meet up for beers or something like that.
Okay, so you do have a number of members out here in California?
Yeah, I'm sure at least a dozen or two in California. That's majority of where folks are at. Poor guys pay too much taxes out there.
That's poor people paying all the taxes.
Yeah. But then we'll show you the good stuff, like where to put your passive investments to circumvent the state taxes. That's one that I've been learning about from some folks lately.
Okay. Yeah, I'd certainly be interested in learning more about that, if where's ways to place some of these passive investments so that the state of California can not have their greedy hands out into everything. But
cool, Steve. Thanks for doing this.
All right. Thank you. It was always good talking to you, Lane. And so far, happy with the deals I've done so far and looking to see how they continue progressing and be interested to see what you guys are putting out next year. I think the next couple months, I'm rebuilding up my cash reserves again, and then I'll look to start deploying some stuff. I got lots here to research as well, too.
Yeah. If you need help, let me know, man. But okay. Thanks everybody for listening. If you guys want to do these, put yourself out to the world, shoot me an email, Lane at Simple Passive Cashflow, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This website offers very general information concerning real estate for investment purposes. Every investor situation is unique. Always seek the services of licensed third-party appraisers and inspectors to verify the value and condition of any property you intend to purchase. Use the services of professional title and escrow companies and licensed tax, investment, and or legal advisor before relying on any information contained herein. Information is not guaranteed, as in every investment there is risk. The content found here is just my opinion, and things change, and I reserve the right to change my mind. Above all else, do your own analysis and think for yourself, because in the end, you are the only person who is going to look out for your best interests.
The proceeding is not tax, legal, or investment advice, nor an offer to sell securities or investment products. Always make informed decisions with professional guidance. Get educated and surround yourself with a community at thewealthelevator.com/club.